Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. The ground in Venezuela is now shifting, with most of the opposition ready to participate in elections next year against the country's dictator, Nicolas Maduro. How should the Biden administration and both Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. Congress react to this change?
Now, the opposition has agreed to participate in the elections. And in that sense, they are more united than they've been in a long time. There have been debates in the past about whether to participate in elections or not. There was disagreement over the interim government. But now all the parties there pretty much agree on electoral path, and I think we have an obligation to try to support them.
Over the last 10 years, it seems like the U.S. government has tried just about everything to try to remove dictator Nicolas Maduro from power and restore democracy in Venezuela. Under the Donald Trump administration, the U.S. recognized Juan Guaido as the country's legitimate president. Sanctions against Maduro were tightened. There was even veiled talk of possible U.S. military action. But here we are. It's March 2023. Juan Guaido isn't really a factor anymore. Maduro seems stronger than ever. And the Venezuelan opposition is planning on holding primary elections later this year so they can field a candidate, presumably against Maduro, sometime in 2024. So where does that leave Washington? Here at America's Quarterly, we recently published an interesting article co-written by Juan Cruz and Mark Feierstein. Juan was the top official on Latin America at the White House at the beginning of the Trump administration. Mark held the same job at the end of the Barack Obama years. Their article, available on our website, outlines a bipartisan approach to Venezuelan policy going forward. They argue that the U.S. should stand behind the Venezuelan opposition's decision to participate in an election next year, and offer to lift sanctions on Venezuela in return for concessions from Maduro that would, among other things, make elections more free and fair, such as releasing political prisoners. Today on the AQ podcast, we'll talk about their article and also take a hard look at current conditions in Venezuela and ask whether this is all just another charade, another game by the Maduro regime to fool the international community into thinking it's being reasonable when it actually has no intention of giving up power. So let's get started. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. I thought, though, that before we look ahead, I want to look back for just a moment and ask you what, in your view, are the steps that brought us to this situation that we're in today, and what was the U.S. role in this story? Juan, why don't we start with you?
We're over 2 decades of this chavismo and the slow deterioration of democracy in Venezuela. And we've tried it all. In the last few years, I'd say in the last 10 years or so, we've implemented all sorts of policies and tactics, even with the threat of military action, which is not something we take lightly and is not well received in the region. We found ourselves with few options. And I think that during the Obama administration, one of the things that really got the ball moving was the issue of sanctions. And for the first time, we were implementing sanctions that took it to the individuals, the leaders in the regime who were in charge of bad behavior. You know, as we've looked for tools that could nudge them in the right direction, we ran out of options. And the one that we need to consistently exercise is this whole business about practicing democracy. And that's where we're always going to beat the regime. No matter what they do, democracy always seems to win out. There are a lot of examples in this, and Mark and I can get into it. But certainly, there have been elections where we've been surprised, and the opposition has come out ahead because they decided to play the game in uneven rules and have come up on top.
Mark, as Juan Cruz noted, you served on the National Security Council on Latin America policy during the Obama administration. Juan mentioned sanctions. When you look back at sort of the broad sweep of the last 10 years, as Juan Cruz just did, I mean, what, from a U.S. perspective, in terms of the policy towards Venezuela, what do you think worked, and what do you wish in retrospect had been done differently?
So as we talk about the U.S. role, I think it's important to talk about the democratic opposition in Venezuela, because the United States has very much taken its lead from the opposition there. And they have tried various approaches, as Juan noted, to try to preserve democracy and promote political change. They tried demonstrations. They engaged with elements of the military and government to try to remove Maduro. They established an alternative government at one point, the interim government led by Juan Guaido. And in coordination, the United States, over time, ratcheted up pressure, ultimately sanctioning more than 100 individuals and prohibiting the import of Venezuelan oil. And the United States also, and other countries did, recognize the so-called interim government led by President Guaido. These efforts have obviously failed to preserve democracy in the country. And I think we've reached a moment now where the opposition and the international community are committed to trying to take advantage of the elections scheduled for next year and to try to use those elections to end the political crisis and achieve a democratic opening. And as we say in our article, this is the best opportunity to achieve those goals in many years. It doesn't mean that we're optimistic necessarily. Maybe I would describe myself as hopeful, but I think this is a pragmatic approach. It's a realistic approach. And I think it's a recognition by both the opposition and the U.S. government and other countries that other efforts fell short, but now there is a genuine opportunity. It's going to be challenging, but it's one that we need to take advantage of.
So tell me, how would you define the U.S. government's approach to Venezuela today? They supported Guaido, but they're talking to Maduro, who they don't officially recognize. Where does the administration stand?
So it is complicated. Now, the United States, of course, is engaging with Maduro and other officials in the regime, but it continues to recognize the National Assembly, the National Assembly that was elected in 2015. It recognizes that assembly as the only democratic institution in Venezuela. But I think U.S. policy is actually pretty clear. The Biden administration sees the elections next year as an opportunity to solve the political crisis and to advance democracy in the country. And what they are doing is they're using sanctions, the sanctions largely imposed by the Trump administration, as leverage to induce Maduro to make concessions with regard to electoral conditions. The administration is prepared to lift sanctions if the regime takes positive steps and opens political space, but they're also prepared to maintain those sanctions as long as they need to. Now, the administration has done a bit so far. For example, they granted Chevron a license to expand its operations in the country. That was in exchange for the regime agreeing to return to the negotiations in Mexico and announcing with the opposition a humanitarian agreement that would allow for the channeling of $3 billion of frozen assets through UN systems to provide assistance to people in Venezuela. Now, those talks, of course, are stalled, but there are negotiations ongoing in Caracas between the regime and opposition negotiators. And my understanding is that progress is being made in unblocking the funds that will be channeled through the United Nations for humanitarian assistance. And if that happens, then I'm hopeful that the regime will return to the talks in Mexico, the formal talks, and that those will be able to resume with international participation.
Juan, before we move on to kind of the proposal that you and Mark have worked on, and I don't want to dwell on the past too much because we only have a limited time here, but questions like this do at some level kind of inform the debate and the starting point that we're at right now. The question is, in retrospect, do you think it was a mistake for the Trump administration to recognize Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela? Do you think that set us back and led us to this kind of crossroads that the U.S. policy is at right now?
I certainly understand why it was done, and it opened up new opportunities. At the beginning, I didn't comprehend what exactly they were seeking with naming Juan Guaido, and I guess I was a little obtuse on that, but then it seemed like the right decision up front and very quickly. It helped galvanize support in the region, to help number of countries that were looking to align itself with the United States position to do so. And very quickly, we found ourselves with an abrupt change in the worldview towards Venezuela to our advantage. I would put all that in the plus column. I think soon afterwards, though, it started to crumble. Some deliverables or some commitments made by the Guaido government early on were overly optimistic and ended up disappointing a number of folk. There were a number of issues in that category that culminated, of course, very quickly in the events of the 30 April and sort of the uprising of a number of units in support of Guaido, which was probably not well planned out and not well thought out. And in any event, it lost a lot of its wind and enthusiasm early on, but still served a critical purpose for the U.S. and others to be able to make hard decisions, seize Venezuelan funds and property in various countries and locations. And what that enabled us to do was to, you know, sort of turn the screws heavily on the regime and deny them a lot of the monies that they needed to continue to offer opportunities and monies to the people who are closest in the inner circle and to provide funds and corrupt means to others. All that is, I think, is a positive thing. Now, I think where we sort of failed is what comes next. And naming Guaido in and of itself just didn't get us anywhere else new. And more importantly, while it was very well seen initially in Venezuela, the Venezuelan population started to lose steam when you saw that it really didn't, in their expectations, didn't deliver a free Venezuela and a return to democracy. My own view is it served its purposes, but once we recognized it, I'm one of those advocates who would have liked for it to have survived because for all those reasons, all those positive reasons that I cited, it gives us the opportunity to, with the weight of an interim government, make some decisions that deny the regime much needed funds.
I would just add to that, I think it was an understandable gambit at the time. I think the Trump administration thought there was a unique opportunity by combining the oil sanctions with the recognition of Juan Guaido and the interim government. They thought there was an opportunity to basically promote regime change, if you will. I think what we all understand now is that the so-called maximum pressure policy has not worked. It was not going to work. And that it's not that the regime had other options, that it was able to survive sanctions, that ultimately what we achieved was greater suffering in Venezuela. Now, to be sure, the Maduro regime is largely responsible for the economic crisis, but clearly the sanctions have hurt the Venezuelan people as well and has led to even more migration. There are 7 million Venezuelans currently outside the country who've left just the last few years. And I think that's really why we're at the moment we are now, where both the opposition and the international community are recognizing that the best option we have now to promote democracy in the country and to advance political change is via the electoral process.
And I think it's also important to note that the whole Juan Guaido decision was supported not only by the United States, but by many, if not most, governments around Latin America, as well as the European Union, and even Justin Trudeau's Canada at the time. People, I think, have forgotten that a bit. So you mentioned elections. So let's look at the proposal that you both wrote about in your joint article for America's Quarterly. If you can walk us through what you think should happen now, these initiatives that you can find bipartisan support for in Washington at the moment. And maybe, Mark, we can start with you.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand why we think that an electoral solution might work in Venezuela. And I think it's important first to look at history in other countries. And history demonstrates that democratic oppositions can win elections in authoritarian settings. And there are two notable cases in Latin America, Chile in 1988 and Nicaragua in 1990. In Chile, the opposition defeated Augusto Pinochet, General Pinochet, in a presidential plebiscite. In Nicaragua in 1990, the opposition coalesced behind Violeta Chamorro, and she defeated Daniel Ortega. I had the privilege of working with the opposition in both those countries. I was at the National Democratic Institute at the time. Now, I do understand that the parallels with Venezuela today are not perfect, but I would underscore that in the year before the Chilean and Nicaraguan elections, there was plenty of skepticism. The opposition in both countries was divided. the elections were going to be far from free and fair. But the opposition overcame the obstacles, and people ridiculed the idea that Pinochet Ortega would give up power. But thanks to impressive efforts by the opposition to organize, to mobilize, combined with international pressure, things worked out fairly well. I think it's also important to look at recent electoral history in Venezuela. The opposition has actually done pretty well in elections recently. In 2007, they defeated a constitutional reform that was put forward by Hugo Chavez. In 2015, they won a supermajority in the National Assembly elections. And in 2021, in regional elections, opposition parties actually won more votes than regime-aligned parties did. And that was in a situation in which the opposition was not particularly united, in which they were fielding multiple candidates in individual districts. They were not necessarily encouraging people to vote. So, you know, now the opposition has agreed to participate in the elections. It's a decision that's been made by a broad spectrum of the opposition. And in that sense, they are more united than they've been in a long time. And the opposition previously was divided over tactics, some of the issues we've just been talking about. Some parties supported sanctions, some opposed sanctions. There have been debates in the past about whether to participate in elections or not. There was disagreement over the interim government. But now all the parties there pretty much agree on electoral path, and I think we have an obligation to try to support.
Juan, why do you think this approach will work, given, as you've said, nothing else really has so far?
Well, Brian, I'd like to hit rewind a little bit on this thing and address some of the issues that I share with Mark, but I differ with Mark. I would cite a few things that even though the unity existed in these cases among the opposition parties, the unity was fragile but existed. I would still say that I saw a bit more unity and unity of purpose in those efforts, perhaps, than I've seen in Venezuela. I think that's where I would differ a little bit with Mark. I mean, I think that they've overcome an awful lot and we're on the right track, but I still have some skepticism there. And also, as Mark mentioned, this is a different era and a lot of water under the bridge. And I think that probably non-democratic forces have learned as much or more than we have over what can be accomplished and how to defeat that in these environments. I'm also skeptical because in all of those cases, the military played a role. Even their passive role, as in Nicaragua, was a role. Their choice not to do anything is a choice and also reflected leadership and confidence and solidified the democratic decisions that had been made by the people in those three cases. So I just thought that's important to point out. And it also leads to sort of my divergence on the issue of elections. I love the elections as an instrument of methodology and means for the opposition party to connect with its people, to practice politics, to campaign, to develop platforms, to watch new leaders emerge and new candidates, and to appeal to its base. If you don't do that, you cease to be a functioning political party, regardless of whatever uneven playing field they're dealt by the regime. And I also have great hope, that's the word that Mark used, I have great hope in what turns out to be what Mark and I believe is the potential for power sharing or for a democratic opening. I have hope that that's one more instrument. I'm less hopeful that this will be that the opposition wins and the regime steps aside and Pollyannishly we have a new government. I don't share that view, and I don't think Mark does either, but we do believe that we need to play the game and we need to show how it's done and we need to fortify the democracy of the parties and give people hope that they can participate in something, that they can get behind ideology and views. You know, there's a large percentage of the Venezuelan population that's, I wouldn't call it apolitical, but they don't side with the opposition or the regime. And that independent view is important. And we give them an opportunity to express themselves during an election.
I think that's all right. I agree with the bulk of that. I think in terms of opposition unity, it's going to be tested this year. There's going to be an opposition primary in October. And you know, a range of candidates have already announced their intention to participate. And the idea is that whoever wins that primary, the entire opposition will back that candidate. Now, we'll see if that happens. It's going to be very complicated to organize and carry out that primary. And it'll be a test to see whether all parties line up behind the winner. But I think that'll be a key test, and I'm hopeful about that. But I think it's also important to consider that the election is actually an opportunity for the regime. Nicolas Maduro wants legitimacy. He wants sanctions lifted. That's not going to happen without the holding of a credible election. And frankly, it's not impossible for Maduro to win re-election. The standing of opposition figures has declined in recent years. And if the opposition does not run a single candidate, Maduro could very well win. And we know the regime is going to try to divide the opposition. Now, the election won't be free and fair. Like let's just discard that term. It'll be an unfair election. I think there are certain minimal conditions that must be met. And, you know, as Juan said, democratic transition via elections in Venezuela is maybe unlikely, but it is possible. And to quote a leading opposition figure there, politics is still possible in Venezuela. It's hard. The environment is still repressive, but it's not Cuba. It's not Nicaragua. Politics is still possible there.
Mark, I'm glad that you acknowledge that the elections won't be free and fair, because so much of the debate around this, and one question that I had about the article that you guys wrote for America's Quarterly, and if you'll excuse my language here, I have read a lot of different things and thought to myself, essentially, isn't this all bullshit? Meaning, a Maduro government that clearly feels strengthened and empowered at the moment, the odds of them holding an election that is even anything resembling free and fair seems incredibly unlikely. To me, it's the old Peanuts comic strip of Lucy taking the football away from Charlie Brown at the last minute once again. But what I'm hearing from both of you guys is essentially an acknowledgement that, yes, this is probably going to be an unfair election that is not free, but that it's worth having anyway for longer term reasons that might eventually produce an opening in Venezuelan democracy. Is that basically right?
I think that's basically right. We're not Pollyannish. And the idea here is that we don't want anyone else to be Pollyannish either. The strength of the conviction here in the opposition, or anyone who goes towards elections in Venezuela, is that what was possible in the last election in Barinas and Zulia is possible to replicate. So in a proven uneven playing field where you may not have the minimum assurances, if you can win there, and if you can get nationally more votes than the Chavismo gets, then maybe you can, even in an uneven playing field, there is still something to be gotten out of this. Now, caution, the regime learns from Barinas and Zulia and other places, right? So they'll employ new tactics, but I think that the opposition and the Venezuelan people have persevered time and time again in uneven circumstances. Again, we're not saying that you're going to have a perfect outcome. We're not Pollyannish, but we do think there's great value.
I think the regime is going to have three options. One is to allow the election to proceed and most likely see the opposition win the most votes. If that happens, then they can defy the will of the Venezuelan people. And I think that would, in fact, put the regime at risk, because you would have mobilized millions of Venezuelans and then taken away their vote. They could also just shut down the process. But if they're looking for legitimacy, if they're looking for sanctions to be lifted, that's not going to happen. And I think what they should do is try to compete in the election and try to win legitimately. And again, it's not impossible for Maduro to win re-election. And again, the process won't be free and fair. But if the opposition is divided, and if whoever emerges from the primary is not necessarily someone with strong political support, it is conceivable that you see a Maduro re-election. And one would hope that the regime would recognize the opportunity that they have as well.
So these proposals were in your article for America's Quarterly, which as we record this ran about a week ago. What has the reaction been like in Washington from your interlocutors in the Biden administration, as well as perhaps some Republicans in positions of power? What have you heard from elsewhere in the region? What do you see as the viability of this idea going forward?
Yeah, I think the reaction has been fairly positive, because what we're trying to do here is, on the one hand, we lay out sort of a realistic scenario. We're providing a sense of hope and possibility. And again, what we lay out may not be the most likely option, but at this point, it's the only option. The elections provide an opportunity for the opposition, for the international community, and I believe for the regime as well. And I think all parties need to take advantage of that. And it may not work, But for the next 2 years, I think it's incumbent upon the United States and others to do everything possible to increase the likelihood that the process does lead to and produce a democratic opening.
Let me challenge you guys with one piece of feedback that I received after America's Quarterly published this article, which is this idea that actually the United States is losing relevance on this question and others around the region right now, and that it's not likely to have a major seat at the table on this Venezuela issue going forward. This person pointed to the recent CARICOM meeting, which rejected the U.S. approach so far. President López Obrador in Mexico, they're the ones overseeing the negotiations right now between the Maduro government and the opposition. Lula, of course, is back in office in Brazil. Meanwhile, the U.S. has had trouble in places like Peru and Ecuador, hasn't really been able to rein in the Ortegas in Nicaragua. I mean, is it possible that we're sitting here overestimating the protagonism that Washington is likely to have in whatever happens going forward in Venezuela? Maybe, Mark, we can stick with you to address that first.
I think we always overestimate the role the United States can play anywhere, but I think here, this is a case where the United States is driving very much the policy here and influencing how other countries are operating as well. I mean, look, you mentioned Brazil. I think Colombia and Brazil are going to play very important roles. You have two left-wing governments in power there. I think they are better positioned than the U.S. government is to urge Maduro to make concessions to improve conditions for the elections. I've had a number of discussions with senior-level officials in Colombia. I think they are approaching this in an appropriate way. I was encouraged to see the other day that Lula had sent one of his senior advisors to Venezuela to meet with the government and to meet with the opposition. I think there's a recognition throughout the region that the elections present a real possibility. And I think, you know, you're right that the government's in power now. Some of the figures would have been uncomfortable and were uncomfortable with the so-called maximum pressure policy that was pursued by the Trump administration. But I think there is an embracing of this electoral opportunity. And in terms of the United States, look, the United States holds a lot of cards here because the United States has leverage because of it, because of the sanctions. And the regime wants those sanctions lifted. And there are many people in the regime that want a rapprochement with the United States. And what gives the opposition leverage in their engagements and their negotiations with the regime are those sanctions. And obviously, there's coordination between the opposition and the United States in trying to calibrate most effectively those sanctions. So to be sure, I think we often exaggerate the role the United States can play. But I think in this case, the United States is a very, very important actor.
On your question regarding these other players in the region, whether the U.S. plays a role or not, I'd like to say I welcome other players. For much too long, it's been the U.S. in a prevalent role, and a lot of countries avoiding getting involved in this. I welcome Brazil and Colombia and others to have a say. I think there's an opportunity for them, as they have said in other forum, to illustrate that you can be a party of the left and be and play politics and elections and get elected and be there on the strength of your ideology and in convincing the population. And a footnote to that is there is no solution without the United States, right? Mark has outlined what those are, but there is no solution. If you figured out a solution and you tried to sell it and the U.S. wasn't playing, that'd be the end of it.
Juan, let me give you the final word here and just circle back on, you know, a question that I think we've touched on repeatedly in this interview, which is, why would Maduro agree to leave? I mean, if some of this does work over time, why would a leader who is currently sitting there in Caracas, having survived the whole Juan Guaido thing, having survived the 7 million Venezuelans who fled the country since 2015 for largely humanitarian, but also political reasons, a Maduro who is looking out at the neighborhood in South America especially and sees mostly friendly faces. Again, why would this time be different compared to all of these failures and all these attempts that fell short over the last 10, 20 years?
Maduro has the opportunity to leave on his own terms rather than being forced to walk down the plank. He can leave on a high. He can leave with a place in history, not getting thrown out, but choosing his exit and what that exit looks like, and he can take all his ill-gotten gains and enjoy them.
All right. Well, on that note, gentlemen, thank you for your article for us. Thank you for the fresh thinking on a topic that's been around for a long time. Thank you for the effort to align and produce something that was bipartisan and unique. And we will see where this all continues to go. Thanks for joining us so much on the podcast.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly Podcast is produced by Luisa Franco and edited in partnership with Human Group Media.